As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Told it inside, baby, diamond ring.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today we're getting deep into the muck with my guest Evan Shore, who is Muck in Muck and the Myers, the Boston-based garage rock and roll band. Their latest album is Greetings from Muckingham Palace. It's out on Dirty Water Records and features our recent coolest song in the world, I'm Your Man. Let's hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Evan on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and joining me for our coolest conversations today is Evan Shore, a.k.a. Muck, from Muck and the Myers, the Boston, Massachusetts-based garage rock and rollers. How are you, Evan?
I am doing as well as anybody can do, but probably better, you know, considering the circumstances. But yes, it's good to be here in 2021, finally.
Yeah. Well, I didn't officially call the or recognize the change of the calendar year until the inauguration myself. I felt like there was a lot of stuff hanging over from 2020.
Yeah, well, we got a clean slate now and a new slate. So there you go.
There you go. So how have things been in Boston for you over the past year?
Well, Boston's been pretty quiet. There's no live music as there is no live music in most places. So we've had to make our own fun, which is, you know, pretty much consisted of recording 16 or releasing 16 new tracks and kind of switching over to creating videos so that people can see us, because no one can see us because no one's coming to Boston and we're not coming to you. So until that's corrected, you know, we're just going to keep putting out videos and making music. But we are hopeful to come to your hometown soon. And I mean your listeners' hometown.
Have any of your close friends or family contracted the virus?
I hate to bring down the room, but sadly, I did lose a friend to the virus. So, you know, we're being very jovial, but it is sad. And I know people who've gotten it, which is all the more reason why our band is staying in hiding, because we don't want to get it. We want to stay healthy and hopefully see our friends soon. So, that's the story there.
Where are you from originally?
I am from New York originally. Does my accent show that?
No. I mean, I had heard before that that you weren't from Boston originally, and I just wanted to sort of delve into some of your background. So you're from New York, and what accounts for your love of rock and roll?
What accounts for my love of rock and roll? Well, when I was in sixth grade, I went to a graduation party. So I was officially out of sixth grade, and somebody at this party was playing the American Graffiti soundtrack. And that was my real introduction to rock and roll, Buddy Holly, especially. And years later, I found out that Kim Fowley was the guy who was responsible for kind of sequencing the music and creating the original music on that. My life kind of went full circle from discovering rock and roll to actually working with Kim Felley. But yeah, I mean, rock and roll caught me preteen and changed my life. For the better, I'm not sure, but I like to think so.
You mentioned, you know, hearing the soundtrack, and that's kind of the epiphany, the rock and roll epiphany. When did you start playing an instrument? When did you learn guitar?
Pretty much a month later, I got a guitar. So I've been playing since I was 13 or 14. And, you know, they tell you if you're going to be a real musician, you got to start on a classical guitar and, you know, work your way up to an electric guitar. And I did that for about a week and then realized this is ridiculous. I need an electric guitar. So, and that was, you know, much to the chagrin of my parents and my neighbors, that was the beginning of a long love with rock and roll music.
And so your folks, they were supportive of you initially or continually, or what's the story with your folks in rock and roll?
You know, I took guitar lessons for probably 11 months from this older gentleman. And it's pretty much as soon as I switched from classical guitar to electric guitar, the support went out the window. Because, you know, making a career out of rock and roll is, you know, I've often said when you idolize a band like the Ramones that, you know, were notorious for not having, you know, the global success they should have had. It kind of probably rethink your career thoughts when you're modeling yourself after a quote unquote failed band. Although of course now they're legends, but, you know, bands like, the Woggles and Muck of the Myers are kind of still waiting to be legends.
Legends in our own minds.
Right.
Well, did you play in any bands in high school?
I did. What's interesting is, if you know those rock and roll, your listeners may have seen these rock and roll charts where they show the evolution of like Led Zeppelin, and it starts with this band and then the Yardbirds and then the new Yardbirds and then Led Zeppelin, and they show all the members going in and out. I did my family tree of rock and roll, and I discovered that every band that I've ever been in has pulled in one member from the previous band. So my high school band, we just kept replacing members, and now I'm in Muck and the Myers. But if you follow the tree back, you'll see a lineage all the way back to my horrendous cover band that I was in high school. So,
in your horrendous cover band in high school, what were they called and what were some of the covers that you did?
Oh my God. Well, the band was called Undecided because we couldn't agree on anything, including a band name. And we all hated each. I don't know why. I think it was just one of those things where, oh, you got a guitar? I got a bass. You got a drum set? Well, let's make a band and see what happens. And what happens if you don't have that that love for the same music, you end up in a band called Undecided, where you were playing Taking Care of Business, because that's what the drummer wanted to play, and Molly Hatchet. And I was the new guy in the band, so it took me a while to sneak in, you know, a couple of Beatles and Ramones songs and anything that would, you know, that wasn't absolutely horrible. But but you know, our claim to fame is that we entered the gong show contest at the local steakhouse and won a free steak dinner. So I guess we weren't that bad.
Wow, that sounds great. You turned to your folks and you said, "See, Mom and Dad, music can always feed me."
Yep, I sang for my supper.
What got you from New York to Boston? What took you up to Boston?
Well, you know, Boston's not a big college town, but I decided let me have a backup plan for when I decide I'm tired of playing rock and roll. And unfortunately, I never got tired of playing also. And, you know, the Boston music scene, you know, you've been to Boston. It's great. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of bands. Hopefully there'll be a lot of clubs when this pandemic ends. So I really got entrenched into that world and that social life. And I'm one of those people who moved here and just never left and been here longer now than I was in New York. But
Well, in the 80s, you played, I think, some of the Queers. You were also in the Voodoo Dolls. What got you in the Queers?
Well, I saw them in the club, and I just loved them. I mean, they were basically the demented Ramones. And I had always been a big fan of DMZ and J.J. Razzler. Gene, who's in the band called the Odds. I was in the band called the Pets. JJ from DMZ joined the Queers, and they needed a bass player, and I quickly borrowed a bass and then bought a bass and became a bass player for a year or so. I had the honor of playing on the sessions that they did with Jimmy Miller from the Rolling Stones. And that would take a whole other coolest phone call to tell you about what went on at that session. But it was great. I mean, you know, getting to work with Jimmy Miller, being on those tracks. And, you know, eventually I quit the Queers to put my own band together, which was the Voodoo Dolls.
And how would you describe the Voodoo Dolls?
The Voodoo Dolls was a garage punk. I mean, we're kind of like, you know, it's the same thing. I kept stealing members from the previous band. So the Voodoo Dolls kind of morphed into my next band, the Nines, which morphed into Muck and the Myers. But the Voodoo Dolls, you know, we did quite a bit of touring. We had a CD out. We just broke up before the big stuff started to happen. I mean, that was back when that sound, that punk rock, garage rock sound, was actually on terrestrial radio. So, and we were, you know, five good looking young guys playing rock and roll. So, but you know, it's like a lot of the Boston bands, like the Remains, it just didn't happen for us. So,
so the first Muck and the Myers album, that's really you, like a solo album of yours. When did that, when did you start thinking about those recordings, Muck and the Myers? Well, why did you start doing that?
Well, I was in a band called the Nines, and we were just going nowhere. And I started thinking, wow, I'd like to write some different kind of music. I've always really been into the early 60s Merseybeat thing. And I decided, wouldn't it be cool to just kind of make a record that sounds like with the Beatles? You know, so I started writing all this early 60s music for a pretend band called Muck and the Myers. I guess it's kind of like, you know, when the Beatles made Sgt. Pepper and they decided, oh, we're going to be another band and we can do this other thing. And it kind of frees your mind open. So all of a sudden, I was in this imaginary band called Muck and the Myers. And, you know, I did crazy things like pan the vocals all the way to the right and the instruments all the way to the left to make it sound as authentic as I could. And I played it for all my friends, and it was supposed to be a joke. And I made funny names for all the band members. And I had played it for friends, like, you should send this out. And the next thing I know, it's getting released on Amp Records out of Canada. Soundflat put it out as their first original LP. We're being asked to tour, but there's no band. So I had to quickly put a band together so that we could go initially up to Canada to play our first couple of shows. And then eventually, you know, the side project became the main project. The rest is history.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is I'm Your Man. And I think that one is one of Pedro Meyer's tunes, right?
Yeah, well, you know, we really wanted to be coolest song of the week for a while. So we brought in the big guns for this one.
Well, I want to ask you about him because I know he was in the band early on, and then he left for a while. He's since returned. Was he in this initial lineup that you put together when you went up to play Canada, or when was he originally in the band?
So interesting. You know, when I finally put the CD out, it was called All Mucked Up, the Best of Muck and the Myers, because who would have thought that this was, you know, going to be a real band, and it was supposed to be a joke. I had listed the names of the people on the record, and I kind of knew that Linda was going to be the drummer. So I gave the drummer's name as Jesse Best, because it's kind of could be a guy or a girl. And I gave the guitar player's name as Pete, which is American for Pedro, kind of hoping that he would join the band. And he did. So our first show were kind of the current lineup with a different bass player. And actually, when Pedro was playing in a band called the Ape Hangers, who were a pretty big deal. They were on the Empire Records soundtrack, signed to A&M Records. And he couldn't come to Canada with us. So that was kind of the beginning of him not playing with us for several years, but boy, are we glad to have him back. Because he's just awesome. And it's great having another singer and songwriter. And speaking of the Ape Hangers, I'm Your Man was actually an Ape Hangers song back in the day. And I'd go see those guys and You know, it's nice having another songwriter, because if I talk about my own material, I'll sound very egotistical, but I have to say, that song is just killer. What a killer garage rock song. And so we really said we have to do this song. And, you know, we pretty much close all of our shows with this now. So I'm Your Man, Mucking the Myers. Good time.
Very cool. It is very cool tune. We mentioned Pedro, and you mentioned your wife, Linda, the drummer. She's Jesse Best. And so we should mention as well, we got to round things out. You got a bass player, John Quincy Meyer. And I guess if Pedro was like from the original, John Quincy Meyer is kind of the new guy, but still he's been with you guys for a while now, right? How long has he actually played with you?
He joined in late 2006. And, you know, it's kind of like Ken Fox from the Fleshtones. He's still the new guy. There's a band 100 years and he's still the new guy. John Quincy Meyer is still the new guy. But, yeah, he's been with us for almost the entire stretch of the group. So it's nice to have a solid lineup, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2004, you guys won the Underground Garage's National Battle of the Band contest. Was Pedro still in the band at that point?
No, he missed his shot at being on MTV.
And so the guitar player was who? Was that Brian Martin?
Yes.
Okay, yes. So cool. So you had Brian at that point. Tell me about the contest and winning that. What was that like?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, you know, it's funny. We were supposed to play the Boston one because what they did was they had different cities involved in this competition. And then the winner of each city would play each other and have the grand winner. We couldn't play the Boston one due to a scheduling conflict. So we entered in Providence, because Providence, if you're not familiar with geography, is about an hour south of Boston. And we ended up winning in Providence, and It was ugly. People were like, this is fixed. These guys from Boston came and stole it, and they're not even from Providence. Like, we weren't aware of a rule that said you had to enter in the city that you lived in. I don't believe that was a rule, but we ended up winning in Providence and having to basically run out of that club as people chased our van with pitchforks. we went from there to Irving Plaza. And that was the night that MTV was there. We ended up getting stuck in this horrible traffic jam from Boston to New York City. We took 95, which was a big mistake. And we ended up being so late that we missed being filmed and interviewed by MTV. They were going to scratch us from the show, but we made it probably within 5 minutes of when the cutoff was. Played one, and then the MTV guys were unhappy because they had to set the cameras all back up because we were the winners, so they had to film us. So if you ever get a chance to see this this MTV special, you'll notice that all the people I interviewed all look great and sharp, and we're all sweaty and hot because we had just played, and stressed because we almost missed the show. But and you also notice that we're playing about twice as fast as we were supposed to, because I think we were just it was quite a night. But from there, you know, we got to join the bill at Randall's Island, which is probably the greatest night of rock and roll there ever was.
Right. Well, let's set this up for a second, because so Randall's Island is the Little Stevens Underground Garage or Go-Go Festival, happened in the summer. It had this this phenomenal lineup, the Stooges and Bo Diddley and the Strokes and the Creation and yourselves and the Liars and Insomniacs and Fleshtones and the Cynics, and just kind of a who's who of garage rock and roll things from the 60s forward. And it also had this big rotating stage, which got stuck. So did you guys, when you played, was the stage working at that point?
Well, we've been accused of breaking the stage. Now, not maliciously, I assure you. I mean, we definitely bounced around and jumped up and down. So I think the thing was on the way out. But yeah, I mean, I distinctly remember, you know, setting up on, because it was a big round stage. So, you know, the band that was playing facing the audience, but behind them on the other half of the diameter of the circle, you were getting set up. And I remember that the swinging neck breakers were on, and they were kind of spinning around, and then we were coming out, and I remember Stephen pointing to us and going, play, like we're supposed to segue right in.
Yeah.
But the problem was that there was a film crew, and our opening song opened on the vocal, and the camera guy was in between me and the microphone. So there's this awkward silence, and Steven's yelling, go, go, go. And I'm like, I can't go, the guy's in the way. And there's thousands of people watching this, but I think that the stage broke right after we played, which, you know, then because each band had to kind of be set up on the spot as opposed to behind the scenes, the show started to kind of fall behind on schedule. And
so you were able to play for how long? For 15 minutes or 20 minutes? Or
geez, I forget. I think it was about 15 minutes, which for us is like seven songs, so that was fine.
So I was played that day too in the Woggles, but we came on after the stage had broken, and you know they were underneath the stage trying to turn it so that it would be one side would be flush, a performance side was just a little askew, you know, wasn't and had to stop perfectly, and so there's a lot of pushing going on to kind of get it as flush as facing the audience as possible. You know, maybe we're supposed to play 15 or 20 minutes, but our set was cut down to just two songs.
So, well, you know. I'll tell you, this is a whole other story. I'll try to make this quick. Stephen was quite generous, gave each band their own kind of trailer to as a backstage. It was this whole carnival-like atmosphere behind the scenes. And after we played pretty early. So the staff guy comes up with a clipboard and says, hey, we ran short on trailers. Would you mind if a band shared your trailer with you? And we're like, oh, absolutely not. And it ended up being Pete Best of the Beatles, which was probably Pete Best's worst nightmare because he got put in a trailer with like the biggest Beatles fans of all time. And like, we just did not leave this guy alone. It was awesome though. He was wonderful. But the thing is, he had just flown in from Liverpool, I believe. And because we were in his trailer, there'd be a knock on the door saying, oh, Mr. Best, I'm afraid, you know, there's been a problem with the stage and we're going to have to cut your set down to 30 minutes. And then about, you know, an hour later, knock, 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 Mr. Best, there's a big problem. We're going to cut your set down to 20 minutes. And then this went on 15 minutes. Finally, it's like, knock, 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 two songs. So that was, that pretty much affected a lot of people. But like I said, I don't think we broke the stage. We were just, you know, the last ones with the fingerprints on it. That's all.
Well, you had mentioned your sort of music epiphany, rock and roll epiphany, listening to American Graffiti. And I wasn't aware, as you said, that Kim Fowley had a hand in compiling that or working with that project. And then later on, you wind up using him as a producer. He was a DJ here as well in the Underground Garage. He produced your album Hypnotic. So how did you actually wind up hooking up with Kim Fowley, and what was he like to work with?
Well, you know, we kept running into Kim Fowley. He was the MC at Irving Plaza for the Battle of the Bands. Mm-hmm. Then he was at the Rock Around in Las Vegas that we played. He was the host. He was doing a lot of hosting at the time. And then we saw him at the Primitive Festival, which is in Rotterdam. And we just kept running past. So finally, I went up to him and said, hey, would you like to produce our record? And you know, Kim Fowley being Kim Fowley, we didn't know what we were getting into. But I remember he booked us into a studio in Scotland because we were going to be on tour and mm-hmm. we were going to take days off. And to make another really long story short, the ceiling in the studio in Scotland collapsed during a rainstorm and the studio was demolished. So we ended up having to cancel that, and we ended up with 3 days off in Liverpool, England, which is again a whole other story about how we almost killed Alan Williams, the Beatles' first producer. But getting back just to finish this story, we ended up rescheduling the sessions for California and flew out to California and recorded with Kim. And I remember I had sent him demos because just like the first Muck and the Myers record, I make demos of all the songs, and I sent him these demos and said, this is what we'd like to record with you. We'd love to, you know, get your feedback and see what you're thinking. So we get out to his house And there on the kitchen table is the package I sent them, completely unopened, never even listened to it. And we go to the studio, and he the first thing he does is grabs an acoustic guitar off the, it was hanging on the wall, and he puts it in my hands. I go, I don't need to hear your CD. He goes, no, play me your 12 best songs. And what he meant by that was, you know, whatever I sent him on the CD may not have been the best material. And he wanted to hear the whole breadth of our material. So you'd play a couple of, you know, seconds of a song. He'd be like, ugh, terrible, next. And then you'd play another one. He'd be like, that's great. And then he'd start making notes and writing this all down. And, you know, as a producer, that's, you know, it says a lot. He picked what he felt was the best material. Then he put them in order. Then he wrote all the liner notes, and then we recorded.
Wait, so he wrote the liner notes?
Yes. Before. He wrote the liner notes. And then he made us record the record in order. And being an old school producer, we had to complete each song. So, you know, you typically when a rock band goes into the studio, you lay down the, you know, the rhythm tracks, and then you go and do some overdubs. And he completed each song one at a time, 12 songs. And it was actually a really great way of working, unless you're the drummer. If you're the drummer, you're just getting warmed up, and then you got to take a 2-hour break while you finish the songs. But it was quite an experience working with Kim, and definitely missed the guy. He, as Kim said, he's a bad person that does good things.
Well, he passed away in 2015. Did you use him again to produce Dial M for Muck?
No, we did a second session with him that produced a single called Double White Line. And yeah, I believe that is the last session that Kim ever did. So,
well, I should point out, in between Hypnotic and Dial M for Muck, you were working with Jim Diamond. You released a cellar full of Muck in 2011, and you're back with Jim for the latest one, Greetings from Buckingham Palace. Is that right? Did he work on the newest album?
Yes, he did.
Well, what? Tell me about working with Jim.
Well, Jim, for those who are listening who may not know, Jim had a studio in Detroit, Michigan called Ghetto Recorders, and it became like the place to record if you were a garage rock band, if you were the White Stripes or you were the Moody Suzuki, or, you know, later on the Sonics when they reformed. But he had this studio that was just filled with garbage equipment, and I mean that in the good way, just old broken amps that are humming and lousy drums and just real dirty garage rock stuff. And he liked to record the band live, you know, none of this track after track after track. He wanted to capture the energy of the bands. And we love that, because there's nothing better than recording all together in a room and not really worrying if, oh, is this guitar bleeding over into the bass track? And, you know, just getting somebody to actually capture the live rock and roll that is emitting from our amplifiers and drums is what we were looking for. And that's Jim's specialty. And, you know, in the case of the new record, Greetings from Buckingham Palace, which was recorded right before the pandemic, Jim had since moved to France. Ghetto Recorders had closed. So he becomes like this freelance producer. So we ended up flying Jim from France to Boston, because it's cheaper than flying four of us to France. But not as fun, but yeah, we had him in, and he got to experience this massive Boston nor'easter where we got pretty much snowed into the studio for 4 days. So we didn't get to show him around the city at all, but we got to, you know, make this great rock and roll album right here in Boston with our favorite producer.
So we were talking about Pedro's track, I'm Your Man. It's our coolest song in the world this week. You're also very good about coming out with videos. You mentioned making videos, especially because of the pandemic, not being able to tour. You've got one for I'm Your Man. It's got some real celebrities in it. Why don't you tell the people out here in satellite radio listening land about some of the A-list talent you rounded up for that one?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we decided, I don't know how we came up with the concept, but the concept was, let's get all of our favorite people, you know, in bands to sing the chorus to I'm Your Man, because, hey, it's I'm Your Man. How hard is that? So we've got, you know, these are bands that we're friends with, bands that we've played all over the world with. We have Collins from the Paul Collins Beat. We have Joe Emery from the Ugly Beats from Texas. We've got the Fleshtones, Peter Zaremba from the Fleshtones and Sirius XM Radio. We got Ronnie from the Muffs. See, this is the problem. If I try to list everybody, I'm going to forget somebody. So I'll just say we also got this guy who is a singer from the Woggles, and he did a great job.
Oh,
and of course,
that's right.
Cyril Jordan too from Flaming Groovies. But it's just a blast having all our friends be involved with this, and you know, it was really special because we sincerely miss everybody who's in this video. We miss playing with them. We miss seeing them. And it was a great way to get the gang back together.
Right. Well, so when you're making these videos, are you working with the same production team or different folks?
Well, we've worked with lots of different people, but mostly we try to cobble these together ourselves. So we've got the manual out and, you know, we're operating the computer and we have iPhones. We did a big production video many years ago for a song called Doreen, which Maureen Van Zandt was actually really helpful with in terms of providing the Go-Go Girls for and the choreography. And that was a big, you know, what I call a real production with catering and everything. But now it's been a real DIY for us. You know, like I said, we're stuck here. You know, we want people to see us. We want to get our music out there. And anything that we can accomplish with a pen and paper and a green screen, we'll do, and we'll put it out there.
So on the new album, Greetings from Buckingham Palace, you cover the Mersey band, the Big Three, doing a version of their tune, Don't Start Running Away. In the past, you've covered Jerry and the Pacemakers. I know you played the Cavern Club in the UK. You mentioned Pete Best, sharing the trailer with him. So what is it about the Mersey scene that resonates so loudly in that mucked up brain of yours?
I don't know. You know, I wasn't there, so I can't speak of it. Although I've, you know, there's been other moments in time where there's just been, you know, a local club, like every city has at some point had like a Cavern Club that's got a great scene with great bands and great people. And that whole era, there's just something about the spirit of that 62, 63 Liverpool sound with bands like, you know, like you said, Jerry and the Pacemakers, the Beatles, the Foremost, the Big Three, the Denisons, all these great Merseybeat bands, many undiscovered. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the swing of the drums or just the primitive guitar, but and the three-part harmonies, it's just such a special point in music. And when I was doing All Mucked Up, which was supposed to emulate that era, I kind of looked at it and still look at it, that music era was very short-lived. And I kind of feel like there's a lot more to explore there. There's, mm-hmm. there's a lot more songs that can be written without being cliche. It's not about really rehashing the sound. It's about kind of trying to figure out, geez, if this had lasted another year or two, where would it have gone? I like to think that that's that's what Muck and the Miser is, taking that classic sound and making something new out of it, an original.
So Jerry Marsden of Jerry and the Pacemakers passed away recently. You mentioned, you know, being able to meet, hang out with Pete Best. Were you ever able to meet Jerry Marsden?
No, you know, and I really always wanted to meet him. You know, I mentioned earlier that we got stuck in Liverpool for 3 days after the ceiling collapsed on the Scottish recording studio, because we were on tour, and we had you carved out 3 days of the tour to be in Scotland, and we ended up in Liverpool, and that was great. We ended up just by chance staying in this, I'll call it a hotel, but really it was a hostel. And Alan Williams, who was the Beatles' first manager, his daughter, it turns out, worked at this hostel, and they had a sign that said, if you're a Beatles fan and you'd like to meet Alan Williams and there's enough of you, he'll meet you. So sure enough, we ended up getting a piece of paper slid on our door because we had called the number saying, yeah, we want to meet him. And they said, Mr. Williams will meet you at the Grapes. And the Grapes is the bar down the street from the Cavern Club where the Beatles used to drink, because the Cavern didn't liquor back then. So we're sitting in the Grapes, and we're like, he's not coming. There's no, and then sure enough, Alan Williams comes in. We ended up buying it. Alan Williams is drinking wine. We ended up buying him wine. And then we ended up taking him and his I guess it was his ex-wife, Burrow Williams, who I think drove the band, when the Beatles were in Hamburg. We ended up having dinner with them, and Alan's just drinking more and more wine. And we kind of realized soon after that this is just like a thing that he did. He'd get Beatles fans to buy him dinner and wine, and then he'd just, you know, talk to them. So we ended up, but he ended up taking us all over Liverpool. Liverpool took us to the Jacaranda, took us to Ye Crack, all the places that the Beatles would drink or play. The problem is the more wine that we got him, the more belligerent he got. So at the beginning of the night, he's basically saying, I could only take the Beatles this far. He's holding his hand up. But Epstein, you know, he was able to take them all the way. But by the end of the night, he was like, that goddamn Joe Lennon, what a jerk. Those guys were on the television in front of the Queen. I took my shoe and threw it at the television set. So, but he was so gone at the end of the night that he could barely walk. And we really thought that he was going to die that night, because I don't know how he got home, but we didn't want to be the band that killed Alan Williams. But we did ask him to manage us, and he declined us that night.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, he has a track record for turning down the best, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. Yeah. But I would have loved to see Jerry that night. I mean, we ended up going to Pete Best's house to see the Casbah Club, which is in the basement of the old Best family. And we ended up doing the whole Liverpool Beatles geek tour thing. And, but yeah, we didn't meet any other celebrities other than, Alan Williams. It would have been, I guess we didn't try hard enough. I guess we could have looked up Marsden in the phone book and see what we found, but, he probably wouldn't have wanted to see us anyway. So.
Well, man, just sticking there with Adam was pretty terrific. I mean, that's a pretty great story. Let me ask you this. So the pandemic, you know, curtailed all the touring normally that would have gone on. And speaking about that, you guys are definitely a very special breed of road dog, you know, bands that tour a lot, referred to as being road dogs. And like the little engine that could, you've worked out ways to play not only across the U.S. and Europe, but you've also done gigs in South America and Japan. How have you managed to do all this?
Well, we've learned to sleep on planes. That's one way. I've got a whole apparatus that I travel with now. You know, it involves earplugs, white noise, a pillow. But yeah, I mean, we kind of modeled ourselves once again after the Ramones. The Ramones were never on a worldwide tour. It seems, you know, they played 6,000 shows, whatever it was. But the Ramones would fly to the West Coast, play a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks tops, I would guess, and then come home and then go out and do the next area. Okay, we're going to do the Midwest. Okay, we're going to do Europe for 2 or 3 weeks. We kind of do the same thing. But it's really less strategic than the Ramones, because the Ramones, being on Sire Records and promoting records, we're just like, where do we want to go next? I haven't seen the Ugly Beats in a while. Let's go to Texas. I haven't seen Manfred in a while. Let's go to Atlanta. So, but, you know, we try to do as much as we can do, being a small band on a small label or small labels. But the trick is to get out there and play, because that's ultimately that's what we love to do, is play live.
When I'm touring, it's kind of like a Tennessee Williams play, you know, depending on the kindness of strangers to find places to crash a lot of the time because hotels are too expensive. But you guys seem to have worked out some kind of system where you're able to stay in hotels a lot of the time. And how have you managed to work all that out?
Well, you know, The first thing is that we don't have a deep payroll. but I can't tell you some of our super secret travel tips, but let me tell you that we are enrolled in every frequent flyer program and every loyalty program there is. And many, a free night has been enjoyed by our band, and many a free flight as well. And, you know, if it's... It may appear that we are the hotelery band, but quite frankly, and as you know, when we head out on a proper tour of Europe, which will be 10 to 15 days or whatever, it's pretty much we stay wherever they put us. And some of those are, I used to call it not the best Western, it would be the worst Western. Where, instead of the double tree, it was definitely the single tree. So, you know, you kind of, and then of course, hostels are very big, and we refer to those as hostiles, but we've stayed, you know, we've lived it up high. We've slept in squats, literally in East Germany. You know, we've seen the Woggle's name written on the walls in some squats. So we know that we're following in some footsteps there. I remember Austria.
That's a road best not taken. That's a road best not taken. Well, I think that's something to point out to folks too, is that when you're touring Europe, it is normal for the promoter, the club, to put the band up. And as you said, sometimes those can be not the accommodations that you would choose normally by any stretch. But that's a big difference as opposed to playing in the U.S. where, you know, unless you're in a top tier sort of a touring act, you know, you're lucky to get paid. You know, if there's a guarantee, you're lucky to get that. And you're certainly, the club's not going to have any hand in arranging or setting up a place for you to stay. And you're just pretty much on your own, you know, whether you choose to sleep in the van or give out that hard earned cash for a hotel, or, you know, work your way make some new friends and see if they will invite you to sleep on their floor that night.
Right. The one good thing I'll say about touring in the U.S., because, you know, you aren't getting those accommodations. You aren't getting typically the meal from the promoter, although sometimes you do, is at least we have heat. Because I just remember making the mistake of touring Germany in December and January. And wow. I mean, they have heat. Don't get me wrong. But it's not the heat that we appreciate here in the U.S.
That's right. It's the radiator heat. Yeah. You know? So it's either on or it's off. So you're either sweltering and you have to open up all the windows, and then it'll be shut off at some point. You haven't any control over, and you wake up shivering, and now the room is freezing and it's ice cold.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So you make these videos. Have you done any live streaming things?
You know, the band's been kind of avoiding each other just because of, we don't want to get each other sick. Yeah. But we did, you know, we got together briefly. We made another record that came out before this new one called Take Me Back to Planet Earth.
It's on Rumbar Records, right?
Right. So that was like the whole, the whole Abbey Road Let It Be joke, is that, you know, we recorded that record after Greetings from Buckingham Palace, but it came out first. So we've kind of been saying that Greetings from Buckingham Palace is like our Let It Be, although without the breakup. but yeah, I mean, we did get together on Jesse Best's birthday, our drummer, November 7th, and just to make sure that we still knew how to play, and we did. So we like, okay, we're still good. Let's take a little time off and see what happens with this virus. And, you know, fortunately, like I said, we've got, you know, we released, 16 brand new songs over the last 9 months. So we've got that momentum to kind of hopefully ride us through to the end of this pandemic, when we can get together and hopefully get a tour going.
Well, there are a lot of great tracks on the new album outside of Our Coolest Song in the World. And I also mentioned Don't Start Running Away Already, but there's also Cupid's Not a Friend of Mine, Strange Waves, Mint Condition. Are those all songs that you happen to write?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we wrote something like 25 songs for that record, and, you know, just kind of whittled it down to our favorites. And so, it's always nice to have a back catalog of stuff. But yeah, those are all, the covers ended up on the record, because we had extra tape and time when we did the record. We kind of plowed through so fast. There was still like 8 minutes of tape left, and we're very frugal. So, because we do record to tape, believe it or not. We wanted to make sure we got our money's worth out of the reel. Ended up doing the big three cover and a Break It All by Los Shakers from Uruguay. So
The song The Way It Was Before, so that's, is that, did Pedro write that?
Yeah, that's another Pedro hit. Pedro's got three songs on the new record, and they're spectacular.
His third one is Good Enough. Is that the other one that he wrote?
Yes.
Yeah. So the way it was before, that's got kind of a Flaming Groovy vibe to me on that one.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I can see that.
Well, you know, the only thing, we only have time to go out with the one more track, and I want us to leave on hashtag loneliness. And that appeared first on a 2018 7-inch called Mucus Maximus. Love all your the titles of your releases. And that, along with a couple of other songs from that EP or on the new album. Was that track also produced by Jim Diamond?
Yeah, we did 14 songs with Jim. And, you know, the record got held up for quite some time. There was just one thing after another. And then when we finally were ready to get the thing out, then the pandemic hit too. But we saw that things were going to be held up early on and decided, you know what, let's grab four songs and do an EP. And that was, you know, about a year and a half ago, we put out Mucus Maximus. And then there was the decision, okay, so now the record's finally going to come out. Do we not put those four songs on this, or do we just, we decided, you know what, put the whole session out. They all sound great together. It's like a happy family. We decided to put the whole, you know, the whole 14 songs out and keep the family together. And it doesn't matter because the Mucus Maximus record's already out of print anyway. So if you want those songs, it's only one place to get them now.
Well, tell me about hashtag loneliness.
Hashtag loneliness. We had a guitar player, you know, we played with for a little while, David Meyerhoff. I don't know if you remember him. He was a permanent fill-in for some time. And he had this whole saying where he didn't believe that you should write songs with anything modern in them, you know, like like cell phones. You don't want to talk about a cell phone in a song because it's not garage rock. But I don't know. I feel like it's nice to bring the garage rock world into the modern world, the kind of the worlds collide there. So you've got hashtag loneliness is trying to get garage rock to the kids out there, you know, they can relate to that.
Well, you know, you've always got kids listening. Those are just kids of all ages.
Right. Well, you know, the older ones can always say pound loneliness. So it works for both people.
Well, I would say the tic-tac-toe sign loneliness.
Tic-tac loneliness. Yes. That's a good one. I like that. We might use that.
Well, Evan Muck, thanks so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Yes, thank you, Manfred. It's thank you to the Underground Garage, Little Steven, and everybody for picking us for the coolest song of the in the world this week. We are flattered and honored, and I can't tell you how much it means to us.
Well, let's listen now to hashtag loneliness off the new album Greetings from Muckingham Palace. It's Muck and the Myers and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Hashtag loneliness. That's Muck and the Myers here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. And that cut is off their latest album, Greetings from Muckingham Palace, out on Dirty Water Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Evan Shore, the band's namesake, for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. Next time, my guest is going to be Mattia Beretta, the bass player in the Italian band Radio Days. Their latest single is called I Gotta Love, and we'll talk about it, and the band as well, on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.